Welcome to CrimeWire, the place for information, news, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show simply by going to the live interactive chat room here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or family member and would like to send CrimeWire information on an unsolved or suspicious death case, or have a specific crime-related topic you'd like to have discussed on a future show, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. Tonight's topic is the Haley Dunn case. I am Kim Colton, Director of Research for CrimeWire, and I'll be manning the switchboard and monitoring the chat room. And now let me introduce the host of tonight's show, Statement Analysis and CrimeWire Consultant, Peter Hyatt. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Kim. Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, thank you. Before we
get
started,
I have my partner in crime on with me.
Excuse me?
I have my partner in crime, Heather, on with us.
That's right, Heather. Welcome. This is your partner in crime.
In more ways than one.
Yeah. How are you tonight, Heather?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you.
When we were first just talking almost before the program began, Kim had had asked if Heather had read Jeff Ashton's book on the Casey Anthony trial. And Heather, I think this is your first time back on radio since the Casey Anthony verdict. Is that true?
It is. It is. I kind of felt pretty disheartened after the fiasco known as the Casey Anthony trial. So took a hiatus from the crime cases that we had covered together. So here I am back, ready to talk about Haley Dunn.
And Kim had felt that the book was beneficial to reading, and I had one of our friends, Meg from Manhattan, had said pretty much the same thing. She was passionate about the case, obviously just devastated like the rest of us, but reading the book helped her, so
I think that was similar. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was cathartic for me. We have to remember Jeff Ashton went through the same feelings, Heather, that you and I and many people went through, and now, especially now with the new information that's come to light regarding her computer searches, it's even more disheartening. But the book actually helped me because Mr. Ashton was able to put it into perspective, and it was very good.
I thought that was good for listeners to hear. I think they felt the same way about the book. My issue, and I shared this with Bacon, was that the fact that Cindy Anthony was not brought up on perjury charges did not sit well with me. That really rattled me because it was just easy, soft pitch, and the talk about her being a grieving grandmother was a joke, and it was deceptive. And I felt that she should have been brought up on perjury charges. She should be sitting in prison along with her daughter.
Oh, most assuredly. And Mr. Ashton does bring that up in the book. He talks about that at length, and he talks about Cindy. And, again, cathartic. He really has an understanding and explains why she wasn't brought up on charges. And again, it's a fantastic read. It's a fast read. It's well worth it. In fact, I sent my copy to Denny, and he goes, "When do you want it back?" I said, "I don't. I want you to spread it around. Share it with as many people as you can, because everybody needs to read this book." I don't know. Maybe one of these days we'll have Jeff Ashton on. What about it, Peter?
Yep, I think it would be interesting for him to be able to talk about it, and I think he probably would. He gave Megan a short answer and probably still smarting from it, because he wasn't defeated by clever or intelligent attorneys. He was defeated, I think, by not just simply the fact that Jose Baez was able to confuse some of the jurors, but I think Heather shares the same belief I have, is that there were some very low intelligent jurors who were manipulated by one or two who were very driven for their own self-promotion and thought they were going to cash in on this thing, not realizing the public backlash would be what it is. We still don't have a made-for-TV movie because of the public backlash. So it'd be interesting to hear Jeff himself talk, and I'm not sure if he's ready yet, but that would be a good program.
Oh, it would be an excellent program.
The smarting that we all feel, that bitterness,
yes,
comes because of the lack of justice. And
yes,
people feel this way about Haley Dunn. Haley was 13 years old when she went missing, and what infuriated people was not just that she died at the hands of her mother and her mother's boyfriend, but that the mother herself has drawn more attention to the case, which yet is not to be adjudicated, not adjudicated as of yet, but the mother is drawing attention to the case by going public constantly. And one of the things we wanted to talk about tonight was some of the principles of statement analysis and how Haley's death will be avenged. There will be justice.
But, I hope so. It's been almost 2 years.
I believe so. But I also want listeners to know that good can come of bad. Good can come from the bad things. And sometimes when a young person dies, other people's lives are changed or touched by that death. And that's a comfort to those who cared. In Haley's case, there wasn't a lot of people to care for her and protect her on the spot. Her father was busy just kind of smoking pot and letting the world go by. But the grandmother loved her. But there was so much drugs around her. I know that the school teacher loved her. And there were people, of course. But there wasn't the type of love, an efficacious love, that stood up and protected her and said, no, this is a guy you called the police on. No, this is a violent pervert. He's not coming into this home. There was no protection of Haley in life. But now strangers have come forward who have dedicated their lives to seeing this through to the end and seeing justice for Haley. There were people that searched and searched while Billie Jean Dunn sat and held them in contempt. But there's also something good, Kim, that I wanted to talk about tonight that has come from Haley's death. And this is what I want listeners to know. Yes, I believe justice is coming. Yes, I still believe that the prosecution will be successful. There will be two arrests, in the very least, and Billie Jean Dunn and Sean Atkins will be held accountable for her death. And the attendant crimes, including child pornography, drug abuse, child neglect, and some of the other things that may factor into the case, they'll be answered for too. We have to be patient. We have to trust that they know what they're doing so they can get a conviction. We have to be patient. We don't have a choice.
We don't have
a choice. In the meanwhile, I think it may help to know that the mother's boasting and bragging and challenging on Facebook and in the media and with her little circle of people who project their own neglect and abuse of their own children onto her, that little Charlie Manson type of following, as she does all these things, what she has done is there are investigators all over the country who are learning to discern deception using Billie Jean Dunn as an example.
That's, if we can train, if investigators can be trained by her mistakes or her actions, that's fantastic.
It's bringing something, I think, of a comfort
back
to those who loved Haley. I believe that there were people that knew her that weren't related to her that loved her. But the strangers that have cared more for her without having ever met her, the people that are passionate about finding justice, I want them to know that all over this country, investigators are learning from the very statements of Billie Jean Dunn that will solve other crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is a question I want to answer. People ask, why does Billie Jean Dunn talk so much? Does she just need the attention and that sort of thing?
Yeah.
And it's more than that. It's more than that. And this is where I'd like to start. If someone is listening for the first time, they can grasp onto this. A 13-year-old girl went missing. Her mother reported that she went out to a sleepover, and around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and she never was heard from or seen again. And the mother received a phone call from the producers of the Nancy Grace Show asking, would you like to highlight your daughter's disappearance on the program? Or however they contacted her, through phone or email, whatever. But that was the basic, that's the gist of it, that the producers offered to put her on the show. The mother said yes. And this is what I'd like the listeners to listen to very carefully. When someone is interviewed on television, the focus of the interview is not to get information so much. That's more of a peripheral. The focus of the interview is upon the television host. The television host likes to speak a lot, likes to draw a lot of attention to himself or herself, and doesn't so much seek information. So they often ask compound questions. They often interrupt. They often try to guide the interview, things that good investigators never do. We never interrupt. We do not guide the interview. We allow the interview to guide us. We ask open-ended questions like what happened and what happened next, and we listen to where a person starts. With a pathological liar, with someone who is outright deceptive on a very serious case like this, the information from some open-ended questions is stunning, and this is what I'd like everyone to look at. When the mother appeared on the show, she was first thanked for coming on, and the first thing that Nancy Grace said was, Ms. Dunn, how far did she have to go to get to the little sleepover? And there's not a good question. It could be a good question for later on. The best question is, tell us what happened, and then you listen very carefully to where a person begins a story. Most people will begin the story with, my daughter went missing, and just break down there. I need everyone to kind of think about the Solomon wisdom of the maternal instincts and put themselves in Billie Jean's shoes and pretend it's their own daughter or granddaughter that went missing. So how far did she have to go? Billie Jean said, 4 or 5 blocks. Yeah, that's a very good answer. It answers the question how far she had to go. We know that when someone is lying, when someone is deceptive, they will have a need to persuade. And this is where the critical information is found. This next part of it is called going out of bounds of the question. So the question is, how far did she have to go? Any information that go beyond the bounds, that goes beyond the bounds of that answer, is extremely important information for the investigators. Then Nancy Grace said, what happened? And Billie Jean gave her answer. On the first day, on the first appearance, in the first 5 minutes of the program, when these two questions were asked, we, the audience, knew Haley was dead and the mother needed an alibi.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what we give to investigators. We call it an intuitive test. Someone that maybe hadn't heard of the case, we ask them to look at these two answers to see what they can find. Some in readership from the statement analysis blog are sharp as razor knives and can pick this up easily, but this is for all to hear. Miss Dunn, how far did she have to go to get to the little sleepover? Billie Jean Dunn answers, 4 to 5 blocks. It wasn't rare for Haley to walk a short distance during daylight. She wasn't allowed to go out after dark, especially to walk, but she only had 4 or 5 blocks to go. What we find the mother there doing is attempting to persuade that she's a really good and responsible mother. What she did was she told us that Haley was dead. She referenced her own daughter missing in the past tense. That is an indication that the mother knows or believes the child is dead. So the first question to be asked by me to the police is, did you tell the mother anything to let her believe that the child was dead? And they told me no. In fact, they were looking at this as a missing persons case. And I said, this is not a missing person case. This is a homicide. It's a domestic homicide. Mother and boyfriend are responsible. And they said, you know, how do you know? And they're obviously not willing to share information with me at this point. And I said, because you can look back to the Susan Smith case, where she reported her her car jacked by a black male in the Carolinas, and the local investigators were doing roadblocks and stopping black males looking for the two missing boys, so Susan Smith, the sons,
mm-hmm.
when an analyst called locally and said, hey, you can stop your roadblocks. The boys are dead, and the killer's on TV crying tears right now. That's the mother. She
mm-hmm.
said, my boys needed me, which raised the question, don't your boys still need you? By referencing them in the past tense, she was giving a verbal indication, a slip-up, that the boys were dead. Mm-hmm. And indeed, they were. She had killed them. Casey Anthony did it. Heather, you remember Casey Anthony when talking about Kaylee in the park?
Oh, yeah.
He said Kaylee loved the park.
Kaylee loved the park. And then she did correct herself. She loves the park.
Right. And I think that it seems to me that parents who have guilty knowledge of a missing child who is actually dead, they make a point to try and speak in the present tense. And most of their language is in the present tense. And it's the slip-ups that we look for
mm-hmm.
in those types of statements.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I'm sorry, you know, that's an interesting point because there was a therapist on the Nancy Gray show about a month ago who said she read the information on the blog and she misinterpreted it. She said, well, you see, the mother is speaking of her child in the present tense. That means the mother believes the child's alive. Not understanding is that deceptive mothers and innocent mothers will both speak of the child in the present tense. It is the slip, the mistake, where they did not catch themselves in time and they reference the child in the past tense. Just once is all it takes to get us to listen carefully.
Mm-hmm.
I recall sharing with really the FBI's top analyst the baby Ayla case, the first statement that Justin DiPietro made the first time he spoke out because he wouldn't speak out, which itself is an indicator of guilt. When a child goes missing in Walmart while you're shopping, the first thing you do is call the child's name. If a child gets lost in the woods, the first thing you do is call the child's name. When a child is reported missing, the first thing that parents do is call the child's name through media as the police set it up. So when Isabel Chellis went missing, the parents went 5 straight days refusing to speak to media, refusing to speak to their daughter or the kidnapper. We knew there was no kidnapping. Justin DiPietro was the same way, but the cases are linked together, and this is an important touch point, is that Justin DiPietro, the father of baby Ayla, wouldn't speak to the media. He claimed he was, quote, emotionally incapable of calling his daughter's name. Which was an indication that we had a guilty guy in our hands and the failed polygraphs and the blood and the life insurance policy were later confirmed. But just for this point, what was it that brought him out of hiding was that he was called a liar. And this is the point about Billie Jean Dunn. You can call her sexually immoral. You can call her a bad mother. You can call her a drug addict. You can call her anything you want. But if you call her a liar, she will reach down into her linguistic code and bring out sexual violent imagery to insult the person, to insult me or someone else. Pathological liars cannot bear being exposed. They will literally sue someone, be forced to testify and take the stand, and go to prison themselves just because they can't bear being seen as deceptive. And this goes to one of our principles, the principle that no one can lie twice. In other words, if someone has the ability mm-hmm. to say, I didn't do it, and they really did, and they actually take the 3-point reliable denial and issue it falsely, they won't be able to bring themselves to say, you'll have to believe me because I'm telling the truth. They won't be able to lie about their lie. The pride and the ego are just too overwhelming. When Justin DiPietro he wouldn't answer any questions about the baby. And then the mother said, well, he's not even taking my texts or my calls. He went running out and showed the Waterville police, here's my text messages. I responded to her. He wouldn't come out for his baby. He wouldn't come out under pressure from the media or from the police. But he came running out to defend himself from being called a liar about a text message.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what brings them out. So why did Billie Jean Dunn have to say, after she said four or five blocks, I was a good mother, so great a mother, I would let her out going out after dark. It was completely irrelevant.
It was irrelevant, yeah, in past tense.
Yeah, irrelevant information in analysis is deemed doubly important. So when someone says something that seems to be just completely irrelevant, just no connection, no necessity for it at all, as an analyst, we take that and say, that is to be deemed doubly important. So the first thing that was known, the first moments that the Texas Rangers were watching this program was, that child is dead. They're not looking for a living Haley. The mother has told us.
Mm-hmm.
Then we move on to the next part. Heather, anything else to comment about that?
Well, you know, what strikes me about it is she initially answered that question, how far did she have to go, with an appropriate answer of four to five blocks, and then come all the extra details. And it seems to me that in cases where someone is lying, they provide many, many extra details because they're kind of assuming that they're not going to be believed, and they're assuming that someone is going to question this, so I'm going to preempt that by adding all of these extra details in. Does that make sense?
It does. In fact, someone had written recently that Peter Hyatt is not understanding that Billie Jean was saying these things because she knew people weren't going to believe her. They actually just said the same thing that you said. When there's a need to explain away why, we have a problem, and that's this. You know, I'm actually holding this in my hand now as a handout, but these statements that are made by her are public record. They're on a national television program. They are printed out, and all over the country, in classes and in Canada, these words are being taught to investigators who are learning statement analysis. So how far does she have to go? Four or five blocks. Then comes in the ego and the attempt to persuade, I better explain this. I better tell them what a good mother I am because they might suspect me. So she goes on to say, oh, she wasn't allowed out, and inadvertently reference her at in the past tense, indicating that she's dead.
Mm-hmm.
So is that clear?
Yes.
Everyone? Okay.
It is. But I just want to rewind just a little bit. You said something about a three-point, and I tried
reliable
to write it
denial.
Down. Yes.
Okay. You're right. I should have covered that. That's a good question, Ken.
Reliable denial.
Yes.
Okay.
Three components are found in a reliable denial. And the most simplest of things is to say, I didn't do it. In this case, I didn't kill Haley Dunn would be 3 points. Number one is the pronoun I. Number two is the past tense didn't or did not. And number three is specific to the allegation, I did not kill Haley. Sean Atkins, for example, and Billie Jean, have never been able to bring themselves to say it. In all the interviews and all the accusations, Sean gives the number one unreliable denial. He says, I would never hurt that girl. I would never harm her. And so the simplest of things, for instance, if I said, Kim, last night you broke into my house and you stole all my money, you would say, I didn't steal your money. And then if the police came to your door, we're here to investigate, you might interrupt and say, well, stop. I didn't steal his money. It would come easy. It would come often. It would come without sensitivity indicators. You wouldn't say, I don't think I stole the money. Or,
right.
You might say, I didn't steal the money. I've never stolen in my life. That's okay. That's an adequate use of the word never. But if someone said, did you steal the money? And you say, I never stole the money. That's not a reliable denial. It's, I did not take the money. Lance Armstrong repeatedly said, I never doped. But he was unable to bring himself in literally 30 or 40 interviews. He was never able to say, I did not take testosterone. He would say things like, I've never been caught. I've never failed a test. That's like me saying, yeah, I didn't, instead of saying I didn't steal money from the bank, I say, you know, Kim, I've made withdrawals once a week, 50 weeks a year, for 10 years. I've made 500 withdrawals and never been caught stealing. Instead of saying, I didn't steal the money.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah.
You know,
I love
what
that.
What is most fascinating about the principle of the reliable denial to me is that Sean Adkins is aware of things that you have written and talked about on radio programs, Peter, about the reliable denial. He's aware that you said that he is unable to say, I didn't kill Haley, and yet he still can't bring himself to say it, even though he knows that's what you and investigators are looking for him to say. He still can't do it.
He could say, yeah, I mean, he could literally read this and be listening to the program tonight, and greeting Sean, and thank you for the nice kind words you posted recently about me. He could literally go and parrot these words, and that's not what we call the free editing process. The free editing process is where a person is speaking for themselves, choosing their own words, and speaking extemporaneously. Like a 911 call, when someone calls up and says, hello, how's it going? How's the weather? Great. Things are wonderful here. By the way, I'd like to make a missing persons report. My daughter may have been kidnapped. Why do you think she's kidnapped? I have no idea. By the way, I'm Sergio Cellis, is my imitation of Sergio. That type of off-the-charts cartoonish behavior is goofy, but it makes the point that when people are speaking for themselves, they'll choose their own words. The brain will tell the mouth in less than a microsecond what to say. So when Sean starts speaking for himself, he'll put his eyes down and say, I would never hurt that girl. I loved that girl like my own, and other things like that. He can't bring himself to say what an innocent person would say. I didn't kill her. Sure, I'll take a polygraph. In fact, let's do that really, really quickly, because we have to find her. So let's take the polygraph now, because I don't give a rat's patootie. I've got to find her. I don't care what you accuse me of or what anything. Instead, what you get from Billie Jean Dunn is I'm getting a lawyer, I'm going to sue, I'm not getting off the couch to miss my favorite program, people are out searching, don't find her in the mud, and lie after lie after lie. But this is the point tonight, at least, is that her lies are not in vain. Yes, justice will come for Haley, but right now her words are so rich in sample, and more than Sean's, and I believe they're equally responsible, and we can go to some of the theories about how she died, but equally responsible before the law. They'll be charged in concert, and they'll always be linked together. They can play as if they're having war on the Internet or anything else they want. She cannot live without the attention because she needs to control the information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about her being sexually abused as a child, and she told certain people that she had been pimped out by her own father, and she was a stripper, and she has a very sad tale of woe, but she's also a survivalist. She is someone who survives.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And survivors, when they lie, will do anything it takes. And Dr. Lillian Glass, someone who I respect, said
great.
That Billie Jean saw Haley as a sexual rival. And that's why Billie Jean, who, pushing 40, dresses like she's 15, talks like she's 15. She actually dresses like an inappropriate 15-year-old.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. She's almost 40?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I had no idea. You are so right. I've never seen anyone. I thought she was 20. Or the way she dresses, the way she looks. Oh, Peter. Okay.
Yeah, my apology.
Go on.
Any,
keep going.
Yeah, any 15-year-old out there who dress appropriately, I apologize for that reference. It should be an inappropriate 15-year-old she dresses like. And, you know, when she's insulted, she reaches to language, which is always telling, that is violent and sexual. It's all she knows.
Oh.
And she thinks everyone else thinks the same way. Remember the bestiality that was going on? She posted, she wasn't going to deny receiving bestiality pictures, but who hasn't? I haven't. Heather hasn't. Kim, you probably haven't. And
yeah.
I don't know anyone personally that has. But in her world, she, you know, her mother went to jail for drugs. She was arrested for drugs. It's generational, and it's a very different world than most of us understand or consider. So her reference point is very different. For her, these things are okay. When she went out and stole materials to burn a tattoo in her son's back, she thought she was being a really cool mom. when she brought home a 25-year-old violent boyfriend who she called MHMR, standing for mental health, mental retardation. This is her compliment.
Really?
Yeah. She thinks that people are going to think that's really great. And what people that cared about her did was they tried to get her to cover up her clothing. And she, here she was, her daughter was missing, supposedly, and she's sending racy text messages of her exposing her breast or sticking her tongue out, acting like an immature, inappropriate 15-year-old. Instead of the mother that was supposedly grieving or searching for her daughter or whatever. It's hard to explain, but there's not a single analyst or crime profiler or anyone in what we call the business of criminal justice. There's no one that has come out to say, no, Billie Jean is telling the truth. Even Mark Klass, who really is just a shoot from the hip type of guy that doesn't think first.
Yeah.
He went to her home. It sounded like they had a lot of personal chatting that went on. He coached her on how to actually address her daughter, things that the police were furious about, that he had no business doing. And then later on, he looked foolish by having to say, well, she lied and she should be ashamed of herself. And how is it that he did not know this from the beginning? How could he listen to her answers and not know? Listen to her next answer. Is it okay to go on? Either of you had a question?
No, I'm ready to go on to go ahead. Next,
okay.
If you're ready.
Yeah, then Kim, if you have questions from the chat room,
well, yes,
glad to take
yes,
them.
Yes, I do. A Boston lady mentioned when you were talking about Billy trying to look younger, she was talking about a Christmas picture, and she said she is wearing Haley's pink jacket in the Christmas picture, meaning, and Billy is wearing pink and white tennis shoes. So she's wearing Haley's pink jacket and pink and white tennis shoes. Haley is wearing black ones. When reported what she was wearing when she went missing, Billy said pink and white tennis shoes. Does that make sense? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's not surprising.
So in the Christmas picture, she's wearing Haley's pink jacket and pink and white tennis shoes. And then when she says, my daughter's missing, what was she wearing? Pink and white tennis shoes.
What's happened since...
It's so weird.
Yeah. What's happened, and people are noticing this, is that Billie Jean is not speaking from memory. She often says things like I said, it's a self-reference, meaning that I'm speaking from what I said earlier. She gets mixed up because, simply, she wasn't telling the truth. And the truth is very easy to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So when she now speaks and she gets all the different facts mixed up and the time things, it's hard for her to keep track of those things. And then I think her supporters, at least I'm told, will quickly delete her mistakes and her deception and that sort of thing. But it only infuriates others. But there's no one in the crime world that thinks that Haley's alive and Billie Jean Dunn and Sean Atkins are innocent. There's no one. There's no expert. There's no debate. There's no. It's almost like it's so amateurish. She's such a lowbrow amateur in this sort of thing that it's laughable. So how far did she have to go? 4 or 5 blocks, good answer, but not satisfactory for a liar. She had to go on and reference her child in the past tense in an attempt to portray herself in a positive light. This is why when we were watching the show, Heather, I don't know if you remember that she mentioned having a toothache. You and I looked at each other and said, drug use. Because, yes, it's possible to have a toothache and it's possible to have pain medicine for a tooth, but what are the odds of being on national television while your child's missing, being caught in all sorts of lies, and suddenly you bring up either A, toothache, B, backache, you know, some kind of unexplained. It's usually an indication that she's taking drugs. So when Nancy Grace caught her, this is how Billie Jean Dunn operates. She said, I didn't have anything I wasn't prescribed. So if 10 years ago you were prescribed pain medicine by your dentist, and then last night you went out and purchased it on the street, the same exact medicine, technically you can tell the truth. I only take what I was prescribed. It's just as illegal. And Nancy Grace made one of those anguished faces where she got tired of the lies and that sort of thing. But what she didn't realize is that in the opening part of the first program, she said, the story reminds me of one of the stories we covered of a young girl in the truecrime.org library here at CNN. Later on, when the pornography issue came out and the bloodlust stuff came out, Billie Jean was challenged about that, and she foolishly said, I downloaded material from your library, Nancy Grace, from the True Crime Library. Well, surprise, surprise, the story that she downloaded and printed out was of a young girl who went out to go to a sleepover and was murdered. That's where Billie Jean got this story from, and she gave that away.
And if you notice, when Billie Jean is, or Sean Adkins, were asked questions that were outside of the script of that story that they had memorized, that's where they fumbled. They had memorized the script, and they would reference the script, but inevitably someone is going to ask a question that's outside of the information contained in that script, and that's where particularly Billie would start to trip all over herself and get caught in lies.
When she was unprepared for an answer, one of the examples of that is when the grandmother got on, the grandmother said that she believed that Sean had raped Haley and Billie had discovered them. And instead of responding with outrage and how could you say that, and Billie said, how come no one did tell me about that? In her hillbilly slang. No one did tell me nothing about that. Not defense of my daughter, not of anything. She wasn't prepared for it. But let's go to the second question because it's really fascinating. Nancy Grace then said, Ms. Dunn, just tell me what happened. And a reporter cut in, and she was last seen a week ago. It's been a week since anyone has seen this beautiful little 13-year-old girl. About 3 o'clock last Monday is the last time anybody saw her alive. And by the way, Mark McClish's research has shown that when someone is going to fabricate a story and they need to choose a number between 1 and 9, they'll choose the number 3. So we saw this recently in the fake hate of Charlie Rogers, 3 masked men broke into my home. The only exception to that is when a police officer pulls someone over, how many drinks did you have? And the typical response is, just 2. That's the most common response. But he found in his research years ago, in his work with the federal marshals, he asked many others to weigh in on that. He had investigators emailing and phoning in that. I have found it to be true. Heather, you said that you have found it to be true.
Yes, I have.
You want to share that example?
No, I don't.
Go ahead.
I have known that. I've noticed that if I'm going to exaggerate something that has to do with giving a specific number, like trying to call someone a certain number of times, or when I try to call someone, if I'm trying to exaggerate that for a certain purpose, I will automatically go to the number 3. Like, oh, I tried to call 3 times, or I called 3 days ago. And I became cognizant of it as Peter and I have been doing trainings across the state of Maine, talking about these statement analysis principles. I just became aware of wow, I'm really doing that. So I'm kind of a skeptic, and I don't really accept things sometimes until I can understand them and see them playing out, and certainly noticing that I tend to do that, to gravitate towards the number 3 when I'm exaggerating, kind of helped me to embrace that principle.
Sorry I put you on the spot there, but I had to do it.
That's okay. Notice how vague I was in passing.
So, Ms. Dunn, tell us what happened. And what we do in statement analysis is that where someone begins an account, the first sentence or two are almost always setting the tone for what someone is going to say. So we listen very carefully because priority is at play. What's the first thing she's going to say? She said she went missing on Monday while I was at work. The very first thing she tells us is she went missing on Monday while I was at work. I can't be blamed for it. This is my alibi. This is what the priority for Billie Jean Dunn was on that day, was making sure that they knew
sure.
I was at work. And if you don't think that's true, just keep listening to her answer. My boyfriend, he came home from work around 3, or he got to my house around 3. He's seen Haley. Haley was there. she told him, "I'm running across the street, my dad's, for a few minutes, but I'm going to Marybeth's, and I'm staying the night there. Let my mom know." So that evening, when he picked me up from work, we got home. We were getting ready for bed. I didn't get worried when I hadn't heard from Haley. I thought she was at Marybeth's. I was kind of upset she didn't call and confirm it with me, but not worried at that point. Tuesday, I was at work again. I left my cell phone at home for my kids to use when I'm working. So Tuesday, I called my son. I said, "Tell Haley, text the little girl, her friend, tell Haley she needs to go ahead and get home." This was around lunch. My son called me back a few minutes later. She said, "Mom, she said Haley never made it over there. She never spent the night." So at that point, I called Haley's dad and found out she didn't go over there, and she didn't stay the night with him. I left from work and went to the police station in Colorado City and reported her missing. Now, A, this is a script, and I'll show how that we know that this is a script, and B, because it's a script and it's written by a deceptive person, it has deception indicators all over it. So the first thing we note about this statement, which as I'm repeating it, and I apologize for the chuckling, it's just that it's amateur night at the Liars Club here, and Billie Jean Dunn has just been voted president.
Oh,
it sounds awkward when people hear it, as it sounds awkward even when people read it. So breaking it down, tell me what happened. She went missing on Monday while I was at work. Now, we actually don't know that. We don't know what time she went missing. But for Billie Jean Dunn, it had to be between 3 and 5, with that two-hour window that she's at work. How come it couldn't be at 5:15 or 6 o'clock? No, for her, it must be that she was at work, so she couldn't be involved. The first thing she does is remove herself from the crime scene. This is very important to her. She went missing while I was at work. My boyfriend, he came home from work around 3, the liar's number, or he got to my house around 3. So at that point, we realize that she does not have the story down straight about the boyfriend. Is it that he went to work, came home, or is it that he got fired, or is it that he got in a fight with a supervisor, or is it that he drove to work, looked at everyone, made sure people made eye contact with him, bought a soda, this is the amateur hour, bought a soda from the soda machine in the morning so that he could be, fingerprints were there and he'd be present and he'd have proof there, and then leaving 6, 7, 8 hours to go before he gets home. So he told different stories simply because they hadn't put their stories together yet. They did not rehearse it well enough, but even when liars do, they still get caught. So here, she's trying to build an alibi, not only for herself, but she's trying to build an alibi for her boyfriend. She does not introduce him by a name, my boyfriend Sean or my boyfriend Sean Atkins, which told us immediately, without knowing anything about this case, that the relationship with the boyfriend is going to be troublesome.
Mm-hmm.
He came home from work around 3, or he got to my house around 3. This is something that seems almost irrelevant, but she uses what we call the either-or, so that later on, if the story it has to be clarified, she can say, "Well, I did say or." That's something that liars do. Most people with a missing child would not be caring about this sort of thing, even to say that. And then, and then she gets in a lot of trouble, she said. And he's seen Haley. Haley was there. So this kind of makes investigators chuckle. Proper English. I saw Heather. Heather was there. I couldn't see her unless she was there. So it's irrelevant and completely unnecessary information, making it doubly important. She's lying. She needs to persuade that Haley was there. Now, she does the same thing about the sleepover. She didn't spend the night. She didn't spend the night. She never made it over there. She didn't spend the night. If she didn't make it over there, she didn't spend the night. No need to repeat it. That's the problem where we pick up the signals that this is a script. So he's seen Haley. Haley was there. In order to see Haley, Haley has to be there. So it's this foolish type of emphasis that's an attempt to persuade. So what we ask ourselves is, what is she trying to get us to believe? And the answer is very simple, that Haley was there. And this is where we run into a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Where was Haley, or where was Haley's body? And this is where it gets really quite sad. She told him, I'm running across the street to my dad's house for a few minutes, but, which refutes that which comes beforehand, I'm going to marry Bess. Now, why would it be needed to use the word but? And I'm staying the night there, let my mom know. So, that evening, when he picked me up from work, we got home. That type of short, choppy sentence tells us, when he picked me up from work, we got home. By using those extra unnecessary words, she told us that she must have gone someplace else before she got home. And this is the signal that Billy, as you're listening to this, I'm sorry it's coming unraveling for you, but this is the way it works when we lie.
Yep.
By the extra emphasis, we got home, is what signaled investigators they didn't go straight home from work. Where did you go? Oh, I went to see my mom to see if she needed anything. And then I went, did you go anywhere else? I stopped off at an ATM machine. That type of silly story, what she had done is she went to her mother's to see if her mother needed any drugs. Her mother apparently was doing well with her own drugs and said, no, I don't need any. So they went to the ATM machine and they blew through all their money. Now, if you, Kim, or you, Heather, wanted to go buy drugs and you went to an ATM machine, where would you take your cash? Where would you go? You wouldn't know because there's no sign on the street corner saying get your Vicodin or your painkillers or your Oxys here.
Rite Aid.
Right.
50% off on Oxys. This showed us completely that Billy Dunn had this type of connection with the drug world, that she knew where to go. She knew who to speak to. She knew how to get a script. This gave us a connection with the drug world. So
it gives us an insight into her world.
Yes, it really does.
Okay,
her language, it would open up her world.
Yeah,
exactly.
I'm sorry
right.
to interrupt.
That's okay. He seen Haley. Haley was there. So the redundancy tells us that Haley's presence is now sensitive and in question or in doubt. Then, I'm going to let Heather take it from here because this is really a strange sentence. When he picked me up from work, we got home, we were getting ready for bed. So what this is called a temporal lacunae, that she's literally jumping over time. That means that important information exists that she doesn't want to reveal in this jump of time. So unless she was working a really late shift where she got home and we're immediately getting ready for bed, this is an attempt to persuade that she went to sleep. But she didn't tell us that she went to sleep. She got home, dinner hour, getting ready for bed, is skipping over time. This is an attempt to persuade that what happened that night, she would like to cover over. Whatever was going on, she'd like to cover over. Then we have what's offered in the negative, but in one of the most strangest sentences that I've seen in a very long time that investigators are now pulling apart. I didn't get worried when I hadn't heard from Haley. I didn't get worried when I hadn't heard from Haley. Two negatives. How do you take that one?
Most people tend to organize time in their minds by what happened, not what didn't happen. So when someone reports not having a particular emotion when an event didn't happen, that's an indication to me that we're looking at deception. Rather than reporting
give an example of that.
Rather than reporting what she felt or thought when something happened, she's saying what she didn't feel when something didn't happen. Now, there are an infinite number of things that didn't happen at any point in time. The president of the United States didn't come to my house today. I didn't I didn't call in sick to work today. Like there are numerous things that didn't happen at different points of the day. So to mark time by one specific thing that didn't happen just is not the way that the human brain works in marking time.
Exactly. See, that's what I was looking for. Like, if you think about what didn't happen today, there's no end to the list of what didn't happen. Not only does she mark time by what didn't happen, but she then gives it what emotion she didn't have. So if I said, I was upset today when I received a phone call, I'm marking time today. I can tell you when I was upset is when I received that phone call. It's like saying, I didn't get upset when I didn't get that phone call. I didn't get upset when the President of the United States did not stop at my house. It's, she is stretching credibility to cartoon-like levels and not even realizing, because she's been doing this since childhood. I'll wager, Tim, a cup of coffee here and now that the people that surrounded her in her life, none of them were rocket scientists.
Because she
is able to get away with lies this stupid, this dumb. Think about how we mark time. I got upset when I heard my dog bark at the door. I got frightened when I heard a rock crash through a window. We'll mark that emotion and that time by what happened. Here, Billie Jean Dunn is marking an emotion she didn't have by something that didn't happen. And I don't know if I've ever seen that before or since.
No, I haven't either. It's very uncommon in speech. You know, even other deceptive people that we've studied and looked at, this is pretty out there.
It is.
Kim, does that make sense in terms of the time marking?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so, right, Heather?
Yeah, this principle, and Peter and I have used this, these specific statements of Billie Jean's in trainings that we've done. So I've done a lot of thinking about this principle in particular, and it really, it's just a very deceptive way of speaking with the double negative and the marking, assigning a non-emotion to a non-event.
The only way to explain it.
I'm assigning
a non-emotion.
So, Peter, I have to ask you, because this is a question that many of our guests have, are the police, the investigation, how do you feel about that? That's basically the bottom line.
Yep. When an investigation is done, the information is then given to a lawyer, either an assistant district attorney or an assistant attorney general. And the lawyer or lawyers will then decide whether they feel they have enough information for a conviction. In most missing persons, especially missing child cases, they know that they have one shot at prosecution. They know that they have time on their side. And what they'll do is they'll say to the investigators, find the body. The body will give clues. Even years later, the body can yield clues. So find the body. The investigators didn't find the body, and frustration grew. The body is located somewhere in that triangle of space between Colorado City, where she was living, the place where he worked, and his grandmother's home. And probably, in my estimation, looking at their language, it's probably, besides the decomposition, in many pieces. And it's like finding a needle in a haystack. So that's the first delay that they experience. The district attorney also had her own investigator looking into it. The local police were looking. The Texas Rangers were involved, and then eventually the FBI were involved. The mother is on Facebook claiming my FBI guy. It's almost goofy that she thinks she has her own little personal FBI guy. as she's talking, he's gathering information, if in fact she's talking to anybody, but that's where the body is. The child the child pornography is something that is a real sore point for many of us, because what they came out with 109,000 deviant images, including images that were proven to be child pornography, not simply computer digitalized information or CAD, but actual evidence of child sexual abuse that were in the home, that were on the computer, that were on the memory sticks that Sean Atkins carried around. They made pornography in the home. Billie Jean Dunn was her own little star in porno. And I mean, it's drugs, sexuality, violence is the perfect storm for a murder. So they have that, but then they have to prove who had access at which different time, and that is something Ray Giudice had said should have been handed over to federal prosecutors. They have an incredible record on that. So if you can't get them on murder, put them away for child pornography. So that remains on the table, even though there were various counties who then had to decide which ones prosecute which parts of it. That became a dispute, and that's the delay is still going on. I do not have contact with the prosecutors. I ask listeners to continue to have confidence that one of these days we're going to wake up and the arrest warrants will be sworn and signed and completed, and those two will be behind bars. Mm-hmm. We just need to be patient, or we can't be patient. We need to be making calls to the prosecutor or writing letters and demanding justice for Haley. Yeah, it really is a point where time has to come to an end somewhere.
It does. It does. And, you know, we opened the show talking about Casey Anthony and how disappointing the verdict was and how devastated and we were, many of us. I'm not alone. You're not alone. Heather's not alone. Many people. But, and same with this case. I mean, it hopefully will come to justice. And I think this one just may do that. For one thing, it's Texas. And you don't want to mess with Texas. I'm telling you that. That's just my opinion, you know.
I agree.
If they've got something on them, if they can get them railed in, which I think they can, I think that something will happen.
I do, and I'm confident that it remains. And I know that we all had hopes that when a body was found, I think it was last March, that it was Haley's, and it wasn't.
No.
There were people that were on the scene that thought it was.
I know.
The people right on the scene that thought it was and reported to us, it's her. And we were all excited that it was going to begin to come to an end. The Casey Anthony verdict has reverberated throughout the country, and I think it has scared prosecutors everywhere about how an attorney can go and lie and deceive and confuse jurors. And so I think everyone is on extra high alert. So Casey Anthony has had more than just an emotional ripping effect.
Then again, would you have been deceived? I wouldn't have been.
Yeah, no. That's the thing I can't say Jeff did anything
individual.
Wrong. Any of those things. I'm not critical of what was done. The evidence was overwhelming, and the jurors themselves said, we believe she did it, but they didn't prove it. Well, then how do you believe she did it? Right, Heather?
Well, she didn't crawl into the bag by herself.
Right.
Excuse me, Heather, go ahead. Heather, please.
Yeah, she didn't put the duct tape over her own mouth and crawl into the bag herself and then throw herself into the woods. I think that there's a real lack of critical thinking sometimes. When that case was getting set to go to trial, I thought, you know, the defense will be able to poke holes in any one piece of evidence, here and there, and they can try that method. But when you look at the evidence in the totality, there's just no way that it can be refuted. And what's stunning is that just the lack of the ability to think critically and look at the big picture and, you know, logically put, you know, 1 + 1 + 1 together,
mm-hmm.
Was just really the most frustrating aspect of that verdict for me.
It was devastating. Peter, we do have there was something interesting here in the, I'm telling you, we have got a full chat room tonight, and everybody's they're chatters, let me tell you. So it's hard to keep up with everybody, but the one question from Cadmar that is just, she says, did Billy drive with Sean to work? I don't know why I zeroed in on that one, but do you know anything about that?
And recently there's been some discussion on Facebook because some of the people that have been following Billie Jean Dunn's statements on Facebook have seen that she has been deceptive and that her stories have changed and that her few supporters that she does have will quickly delete or change or take away some of the statements. And so there was recent discussion about who actually drove Billy that morning. I'll limit my comments to this. The police know who drove. The police know who told the truth and who didn't. The police have the cell phone pings that where things were placed. So it's not so much a mystery to them as it is Billy Dunn just not working from memory when she tries to bamboozle people today. So I wouldn't read too much into it, just that in the beginning they did know. What probably caught the police by surprise, I think, was how much people knew outside the investigation. And one even articulated that to me, that in real strong terms, that people knew after Sean Atkins, for instance, spoke a great deal about the investigation. And that was, I think, somewhat of a surprise that there were some astute readers who were commenting and putting these things out there and knew things. So today they are picking up things where her story has changed and people are trying to jump on those things. But rest assured that they do know and were able to verify different things. For instance, the story about Mary Beth's mother and Billie Jean just couldn't figure out why she would lie, that sort of thing. What it comes down to is that something horrible took place that night. Something horrible. And many people believe that Billie Jean came upon Sean sexually molesting Haley, and Haley may have been drugged, and they had been appeared to be a willing victim, and Billie Jean went and assaulted her. It went too far. She choked her, that sort of thing. But they both went into cover-up mode. Now, before the threats of lawsuits, it was Haley's own grandmother that said this, something similar to this, on national television. What she said was that she believed, or she thought, that Sean had raped Haley and that Haley threatened to tell, so Sean killed her, and that Billy was lying for Sean. That I don't think happened. I think something similar happened, but not that. And the reason being is, if you'll notice about Billie Jean Dunn's language, it's always about her. It's never about Haley. The reason Haley was so special is because God gave her to me, Billy said. So Billy was the center of, linguistically, in the center of her own universe, incredibly narcissistic and selfish. Everything was about her and her need to control the information on television, her need to control media, and the fact that she could hardly conceal how much she liked being on TV and being in the center. So she's come out of the woodworks and gone on Facebook, and she's like a little mini celebrity with 4 followers who just bow at every word she said. And these are the same type of people that Charlie Manson has followers to this day, who, you know, Billie Jean could confess to the thing, and they'd say, oh, it wasn't your fault, and they'd send her roses at Mother's Day and that sort of stuff. They have their own psychological issues to deal with. The bottom line is that she does actually have people that are interested in justice for Haley, and they are listening to what she's saying. And when she's lying or not keeping track of her lies, they're jumping on it. And they're jumping on it in the name of justice for her daughter. Haley has come to mean a lot to a lot of people, and the desire for justice
mm-hmm.
is strong. Heather, do you remember how angry people were when I posted the article, The Death of Haley Dunn, back shortly after she went missing?
Yes.
People fumed.
I do.
Yeah, they fumed because how could you say, why don't you have hope for Haley? And hope for Haley became the catchword. And I didn't have hope for Haley, and I said that she was dead because the mother said so. The mother told us, if you're bothered to listen. And the mother has given us a lot of guidance since then, and she continues to. She can't help herself. She has to have attention. She'll probably one day run for a cellmate president or something like that, but she's in her prison orange jumpsuit or something. But she has this behavior that is continually inappropriate. She called on someone recently to be gang raped.
Wow, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah, someone slighted her or she was mad at her. She wanted the person gang raped. And you'll probably read something this vile about me tomorrow. And she'll go into, and you pointed this out, every insult that she posts seems to always have sexual language and violence mixed together. And, Kim, that's what you said before. This is her world. This is insight into who she is and her lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
She has uncles in jail and brothers in jail and her mother's in jail. And everyone is in and out of jail so often, it's really hard to keep track of. Whereas most families can go an entire extended family and not know someone that went to jail. And if it is,
mm-hmm.
it's like the uncle no one talks about. That sort of thing. It's very rare. Where for
mm-hmm.
these people, in her culture, it's rare that someone doesn't go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
What do we make of Clint Dunn, who did not
Clint?
Have anything to do with his... yep, Clint was Haley's father.
Right.
He did not...
He lived in another state.
No, he was living across the street, across the way from
him. Oh,
that's right.
Yeah.
But I think
he did say
that he wanted to move to another state where pot was legal.
Yes, he had
Didn't
nothing. Yeah, he did. He when I spoke to him, he issued a reliable denial. I did not kill my daughter, Haley. I did not cause her disappearance without sensitivity, and he was truthful. But he, on the first day after she was reported missing, he went over to Billie Jean's house to go searching, to start his own searching. And he had with him his girlfriend or a fiance at the time, and they were pushing their baby carriage, and they were ready to search. And he went into the home. David, who was 16 at the time, was playing video games. And Billie was on the couch watching, according to Clint, her favorite TV show. And she wasn't getting off the couch. And David wasn't budging to look for his sister. What do we make of that? I was once, many years ago, when I was a teenager, we had learned that some boy may have slapped my sister. And my brother and I went out to talk to him very privately to make sure that he never showed his face ever again anywhere near our home. And it could have escalated. It didn't, because he knew that we were dead in earnest. But at age 16, I was raised with seven sisters, never to lift a hand against a woman, but always to be that protector. It is very natural for a 16-year-old to look at his younger 13-year-old sister and say, I'm going to protect her. And what I thought, and I think that Clint was expecting, was this kid was involved in martial arts or karate or tap out or something like that he was going to organize a search and they were going to go out and find her. He's playing video games, Clint said, like there's nothing wrong. I can't imagine. I thought of my own sons, paralyzed with fear or shaking and crying, or better yet, out searching for their sister. Here is he playing video games, and Clint described it as if nothing was wrong. Billie wouldn't budge because from like 3 to 4 was her favorite TV show, and she never misses that, so she wasn't going to budge off the couch. And he thought to himself, where is the urgency? Why aren't people looking? What's going on here? Now, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but, and he said, I did read your analysis about the past tense, and it's really hard for me to think that, but I'm starting to think that her, Sean and her were involved together. But he was afraid of Billie Jean. He was afraid of her. And he said that he was afraid of her. And then later on, he recanted some of the things that he told me and went on to say, no, no, that's not what I said, and he's making these things up and that sort of thing. And then he sent me a hard email saying, why did you repeat those things? And I said, because you were telling me for the radio program to publicize for your daughter. Why are you backpedaling and saying Sean didn't do it? So he had this kind of crazy Sean did it, Sean didn't do it. His hope and dream was to move to California where marijuana was legal so he could get high and just stare at his belly button from the time he wakes up to the time he goes to bed. That was the type of father that Haley had. So, no, he didn't kill Haley, but he didn't protect her either. And, yeah, maybe Sean Atkins was a big guy. He could have gone in and gotten her out of there. When Billy Dunn reported to the police that Sean had to be arrested or removed, she told the police, he threatened me. When they took Sean in, and this is part of his personality, the police are telling the truth, he said, did I threaten her? Sure I did. And I'll kill Haley, too. I threatened to kill her as well, and Clint. Well, he articulated it, and he kept his word. Why didn't anyone get her out of that house?
Oh, I know. Heather, what do you think? Heather?
I think that it's just the sad cycle that we see of neglect. Children of neglect don't really stand a chance. Kids require their parents to be active. Parenting is not a passive thing that... you can do when you feel like it or when it's convenient. And sadly, so many of these kids, Haley, Kaylee, Haley Cummings down in Satsuma, Florida, they were an inconvenience to their parents. And sadly, they all met the same fate.
Well, I have to say, folks, we are almost 15 minutes over time. Everything will be in the archives. We still have 20 online folks listening, even though they probably can't even hear this. But I guess it's a wrap, guys. And this is just so much fun. I cannot tell. It's interesting. It's fun. We've got so many chatters in the chat room. Oh, and by the way, hors d'oeuvres and cocktails will be served in the chat room immediately following the show. Thank you, Peter, and thank you, Heather. I'm so glad, Heather, that you came on tonight, and thank you so much.
Thank you.
And
be here.
Thank you, Kim.
Oh, thank you. And in closing, thanks to our public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be next Tuesday. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases that wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice, and discuss crime-related topics with the experts. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer and the show will automatically play. Good night, everyone. Until next time, God bless and stay safe. Good night.